The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Imagine your home totally organized with Closets by Design. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BY-DESIGN.
It's a brand new best podcast in baseball. The Cardinals sweep the Pirates. The Cardinals sweep a doubleheader from the Mets. They've won five in a row as they head to D.C. in what could be a defining road trip. I'm in the nation's capital, and I get a chance to talk with Rich Waltz, who will be in the booth calling the game for Friday Night Baseball on Apple TV+. We talk about the Cardinals. We talk about the national view of the Cardinals. We talk about the National League Central. We talk about closing the gap on the Dodgers with Rich's experience calling Diamondback games. And we talk about how, as the game of baseball evolves, so too does how people broadcast baseball. All of it, and the answer to this question, which Rich put so well.
The discussion around the Cardinals will be similar to the one that you and I are having right now, is who are these guys and where are they headed? Are the pieces they've got good enough?
All right, it's a brand new best podcast in baseball. Cue the music.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined with this week by baseball broadcaster, part of the Friday Night Baseball crew for Apple TV. It is, of course, Rich Waltz. Rich, thank you so much. As we talk to each other from opposite sides of D.C. here, you're over by the ballpark. I'm over by DuPont Circle, but we'll have a chance to see each other at the ballpark. Thank you very much for taking this time.
No, I'm excited to be here. It's been a while since I've done a game in Washington, D.C., and I'm staying by the ballpark, and it's amazing to me the area around here, because as you know, when this ballpark first came in, this was not an area you really wanted to hang out in. Yeah. And now it's just like crammed full of cool apartments, townhomes, lofts, restaurants, bars, grocery stores. It is a thriving neighborhood. It feels like Washington, D.C. has stretched all the way down to the Anacostia River. And it's really amazing. It's great to see.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was an area where you'd walk around to go see the statues, you know, when after deadline, because they have some really wild statues there for folks who are used to kind of the statue, the Garden of the Greats outside of Busch Stadium. These are a little bit more artsy statues. They kind of capture them in motion. They're really cool at night, but you're right. There wasn't like a place to go grab a bite to eat. And if the metro was closed, there was no way to get to except for to walk somewhat in the direction of the Capitol. So it is great. And, you know, they have the World Series, the All-Star Game. You've seen it grow as they've gotten more marquee events, which is probably a little bit how it's supposed to work, right? Team contends and things grow around it.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, look, the Ballpark Village in St. Louis, it took them a while to get it done, but that's, you know, whenever I do a game in St. Louis and I'm there in 2 weeks, stay downtown at the Westin, great restaurants, walk around, and it's so cool to just walk across the street and into the ballpark, and that's your commute to work. So
you'll be doing the Diamondbacks Cardinals game there at Busch Stadium. You do a lot of work with the Diamondbacks. You called games for the Marlins there for a while, was with the Mariners. As you kind of get prepared for the Cardinals Nationals game, what's your view of the Cardinals as you kind of look in on them after, just getting ready to call the game?
Yeah, when you're calling a national game, it's very different than when you're the voice of a team and you're following them. So you kind of do the view from a mile high just to see, and then you dig a little deeper. My first brush looking at them like a week ago, and then you watch games. I've watched, you know, a lot of their games this week. Mm-hmm. Is there's a lot of interesting pieces on this team. And it's amazing how you win five games in a row and all of a sudden everybody's opinion maybe doesn't change completely, but all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a minute, are these guys good? They just won five in a row. It's 19-19. The season's so young. But at the same time, you also look at these pieces and say, can these pieces add up with some addition to be a team in the next few years that can win a division and get to the postseason and get to the World Series? There was I don't remember the executive who said this, but it's something that I really believe. And they said, middle ground in Major League Baseball is quicksand. And you're either adding to win and get to the postseason, or you're rebuilding at the start. But if you're in the middle, that's a really hard place to be because you got to figure out who you are, what you have, and where you want to go. So there's some really good youth and bats on this team. They're a fun team to watch just in this last week. Obviously, I chose a week where the Cardinals played really well. So, but the question is this a group that they feel if they keep it together and add to it in 2, 3, 4 years can have a run like Cardinal fans are used to having? And I don't know the answer to that. I do know, you know, having watched the press conference, the handing over of the presidency, so to speak, the emphasis was on, we are going to spend more money on tech and instruction and drafting and developing. And that to me sounded like, hey, maybe not a full reboot, but a partial reboot in terms of how they build a team. So, I mean, really interested to see them. Again, that division with the record right now, who knows in a month, if all of a sudden guys get hot, they could win that division. Then again, they're also have, you know, when you look at all the interesting pieces, well, I'm not the only one interested. There's other teams, there's contending teams that may look at this roster and say, wow, this guy could really help us. And so there's that. It's quicksand right now. It's middle ground for the Cardinals. And maybe it's how they play in the next month that pushes the front office to act one way or the other.
I really like that phrase that the middle ground is quicksand. I think it was back in 2019. It might have been 2018. Baseball Prospectus asked me to write the Cardinals essay for their big, you know, yearly kind of tome that they put out. And my lead was that the Cardinals found themselves then at the worst possible place in baseball to be, the middle. Neither rebuilding, neither all in, but just trying to hold the course. And it really is as much quicksand as it, and it's been going on so long with the Cardinals, that it's almost quick-creeked, like they're just stuck there.
Yeah, and the thing I thought about when I heard that press conference of, we want to really add, you know, drafting, more emphasis, more resources on drafting and developing and on tech and all of that. The first thing I thought of was the Dodgers, because to me, you know, the Dodgers spent a ton of money 10, 12 years ago and never got to the World Series and never won it, right? But their payroll was always the highest. It feels like the Dodgers have, over the last 6 years, done a lot of what the Guardians and the Rays and other, you know, resourceful teams do, in emphasis on instructors, emphasis on tech, emphasis on drafting and developing. And by emphasis, I'm talking about pouring money into it. Yet they have the small payroll. The Dodgers seem to be the team that has done the best of both those worlds. They have the huge TV contract. They have all the money to spend, but they're, I mean, you look at some of the guys they've developed, especially pitchers, over the last 6, 7 years, that feels like a smaller market team, but it's the Dodgers, and they can back that development up with, you know, flashy free agent signings.
Absolutely.
You know. So anyways, that, you know, I heard that the Cardinals, that news conference and that emphasis on those few things, which are big things in building an organization that's going to win. I thought to myself, well, you know, that's, the Dodgers do that really well, and they've got all the money, and that's why it seems like they're the kings of the world right now.
Absolutely. They invested heavily in like a coach capital, for lack of a better description. You know, and it was one of the questions that was kicked around the Cardinals, say about two, three years ago, was like, all right, well, the Dodgers have this pitching development coordinator, one for every level. How many do the Cardinals have? Oh, they have one. Or they don't have one for an entire organization. And the Cardinals really, they kind of moved money away from the development, trusting kind of in like their way, no pun intended, that they could identify players and still give, you know, the coaching attention needed. But they then re-spent it on the major league side to kind of beef it up. But again, it was the middle, right? They didn't go all in. They didn't go get the pitcher that they needed. They went and got Arenado, but didn't go beyond it. They went and got Goldschmidt, but didn't go beyond it. And at the meantime, they were just dealing with like such a small staff, Rich, that like, you know, that's where the real big investment has been in the last 12 months, let's say. They've just really expanded, amplified, even exponentially, it feels like, some of their coaching.
That's a good, I mean, that's a, it's good for me to hear that from you. That's a really good sign, because I think that the organizations in baseball that are thriving and that are able to contend, and I use the Guardians and the Rays as an example, they pay their minor league people better. They, mm-hmm. their draft and development, and they pour money into that, which to them is a better, a dollar better spent than splashy, huge free agent contracts. Right. But look, it's, I mean, I think if you're a Cardinal fan, this stuff is in the Cardinals' DNA, right? I mean, they've been good at this. I don't think it'll take them that long to go back and get good at this. And, you know, I was the Marlins TV voice for 13 years, so I saw a lot of it.
Saw a lot of them, yeah.
Yeah, at Roger Dean Stadium from 05 to through the 17 season. It always seemed like there was a steady group of young arms, young dynamic position players coming to the big leagues that you got a lot of viewing in spring training and got to see them. So I think it's in the Cardinals DNA, mm-hmm. That, you know, this shift, I think it will be a positive thing. And I don't think it's going to take as long as it has in other places in terms of, hey, let's get that up to speed.
Yeah, you got to see a lot of the Cardinals' peak development when they were, yes, getting guys like Rosenthal and Matt Adams later in the draft, Matt Carpenter later in the draft, yes, and they were able to turn them in. And then they had that run of utility players that, as you know, had the whole Treasure Coast perplexed. Like, and how could they come up with them?
Yeah, and look, some people think the Cardinal way is hokey, but mm-hmm. I'm a believer. I've never, you know, been associated with that team, but they were, you know, traditionally the games that I called, they were always so fundamentally good. In fact, you know, I had the Pirates and the Padres last week on a Friday night Apple game. Mm. And when we do a game on Friday night, we get to visit with the managers who go into the office and spend a good 20, 25 minutes just breaking down team and getting stuff you usually don't get. And there on Mike Schilt's desk is that little book, the leather book. It's all, you know, earmarked and dog-eared, mm-hmm. and all of that. And it's the Cardinal way, and he still carries it with him. He says he opens it just about every day. So that's to me, that's not hokey. That to me, that having that as a touchstone or a cornerstone to wherever you go or whatever you do in the organization is a real positive.
That's a great. I'm glad to hear that. He was given that notebook by that little leather bound notebook by George Kissel's son. It was a gift to him. Yeah. And on the first page, it says, "Are you an organizational man?" And he said that that's kind of his compass. Am I working every day in the direction of the organization? Obviously, it's with a different organization now, but that has kind of been a guiding light for Schilt.
It's funny because Ryan Spielborgs and I were trying to figure out who it was that we couldn't come up with George Kissel's name. I said maybe it was Red Shandings. I didn't know. I was kind of pulling names out of Cardinal history or something.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was George Kissel. It was the guru of fundamentals, the great George Kissel, who made many a catcher a third baseman and many a third baseman a good outfield, all of those along, and taught a lot of folks how to bunt. But it was his son who had that put together for Schilt and a few others.
That's very cool.
As a gift. Yeah, that's cool. Really neat. Well, you got to see the Pirates as well. The Cardinals sweep the Pirates. They got a 5-game winning streak that they are rolling into DC with. They needed every bit of those wins to get back to 500 for the year, which Sonny Gray told us after the game was good for their psyche, mm-hmm. somewhat of a reward for the style of play that they've had. They've not been very good on the road. Their 5-game winning streak all came at home, and it also led to the first firing or contributed to the first firing of a manager as Derek Shelton goes down to the Pirates and they replace him. So you were just there last week. I mean, does that come as a bit of a surprise for this early? Does it say anything about where the Pirates are as an organization?
A little bit of everything. Yeah. I don't know that it's that big a surprise anytime a franchise like that goes through a long drought. Mm-hmm. But I mean, look, they've never had a payroll over $100 million. The last big free agent, multi-year free agent contract, I think, was back in 04 or something like that.
Yeah.
So look, it's one of those things where you look at Derek Shelton, and I don't know that anybody can answer this question. Is he a good major league manager? How do you know? I mean, there are guys that get jobs in the big leagues, and never have a chance to win because they're the roster that they get is dysfunctional or it's not a complete roster. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you see the owner issuing a statement that we had to make a change, you know, it would be nice if they'd plow some of their money into payroll and supplement. I mean, look, they've got a generational starting pitcher in Paul Skenes, yeah. And they've got some pretty good young players there too. But unless you supplement that and you know, now's the time to build a team around them, you're not going to get anywhere. And so you don't know if Derek Shelton's a really good major league manager. I mean, he's really well respected in the industry. And I'll bet you if you ask other managers and other execs around the league, they'll say, yeah, he's sharp. He's pretty good. You drop him in another city, drop him in Seattle or San Francisco or San Diego or wherever. Suddenly, hey, that guy can really manage. They're going to win 90 games. I think that's a case of just never having the horses, never having an opportunity to be successful as a manager.
Yeah, his peers really speak highly of Shelton, how he manages games, how he sets up traps for them, how he gets his guys in the best position but doesn't always have the best roster. You know, his peers are impressed by him as a manager.
Yeah, and I think he'll get another chance.
Sure.
I mean, the bloodline or the people he's worked for are just too good, and his reputation is really, really good. I mean, remember how much of a struggle it was for Joe Torre early in his career? I mean, he had some
miserable the Cardinals, teams. Yeah.
Right, and the Braves, right?
Yeah.
They weren't very good either. Then suddenly he gets the Yankee job, and he's a genius, and he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Right? Well, the back page of the New York paper was Clueless Joe when they hired him, right?
Right. So, I mean, the landscape of – and this isn't just baseball. This is now college sports or the NFL. There are head coaches in college basketball, NBA, the NHL that get opportunities just because they want the opportunity. And, you know, maybe they're there 3 or 4 years and you just don't know. But oftentimes those coaches get another shot somewhere else. And I've talked to a couple of high profile, lower level. I know that's a dichotomy. college basketball coaches who are really, really good. And they've been offered jobs. And I asked one of them, I said, why haven't you taken, I'll use the name, it's Ben McCollum. Who's now the head coach at Iowa. He won, I think, 3 national championships at Division II. And I called a couple of those on CBS. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, you know, I know you've been offered jobs. Why haven't you taken a D1 job? And he said, because of all the jobs I've been offered, I've only been offered the dire situations. They see me as a guy that can come in and work magic. And he said, I haven't taken those jobs because I don't know that I can be successful in those places. So he waited and waited, and finally, he's an Iowa guy. Drake hired him this last year, and he said yes. Mm. And he took him to the NCAA tournament, won a first-round game using 4 of his starters from D2, and then Iowa just hired him. That's an example of a guy that did it, you know, had to be really, really patient and take the right spot. But for many coaches, many managers, some team will call you. There's a reason they're calling you is because they're not real good. Or in most cases, and you know, it's hard to say no to that. So I wish him well, and I think he's going to land in a better spot, I guess is the best way to say that.
It's a real interesting time in the NL Central because you touched on it there, right? Like the Pirates have such strong pitching. They still have Brian Reynolds there, who's really is an excellent player, just a superb player, would be a real a player who puts a contending team over the top, in my opinion. Then you have the Reds, who have Ellie Dela Cruz and Hunter Green, who are exceptional players. And yet they're on these teams, and it's like, well, are you going to push financially to go that next step to either outfit, in the Pirates' case, that lineup with some folks who can contend, give Brian Reynolds some additional help, or are you going to – and then obviously address the bullpen too – or in the Reds' case, it's like, are you going to take advantage of this talent? Are you going to outfit it? You know, and then you have the Cardinals who are trying to find back to the middle point where they are in this scheme of things. What struck you about kind of the style of the Cardinals in this past week and what you saw from them?
You know, I when they run and the speed, you know, Scott's speed the other day was really fun to watch. They're not dynamic. They're not a real dynamic team in terms of base running and stealing bases. They're kind of middle of the road in that. They don't homer a lot. I mean, no. I think if I were to if I had three wishes that I could bestow upon the Cardinals, the first one would be more slug and more home runs. And when I watched them, we have a great support in terms of research. MLB Network produces the Apple games, and Apple also administrates it, and they've got folks that have input. So it's a really cool blend. And so we have access to MLB Network's research department. And to me, home runs are the at the top of the list for any team. And so I asked our research, go back and for the last, I think it was four or five LCS quartets, the four teams that get to the LCS.
Oh, sure.
And my instinct is they're all really good at hitting home runs. And the last 4 years, three of the four were at least in the top 10 of hitting home runs. So, you know, if I could wave a magic wand for the Cardinals, and it may come from some of these younger players that develop into hitting home runs, it would be more power. They're really good at doubles. And in terms of runs scored and all of that, but a little more slug and a little more home runs would, you know, sprinkle that into their offense. And all of a sudden, I think they'd be good offensively. Obviously, their bullpen is, you know, ERA is middle of the road, but the seven blown saves can be gut punches. And psychologically on a team, especially with some young players in it, blown saves can hit you hard. But Sonny Gray has looked good. Liberatore has looked good. So again, there's pieces there, and yeah. you want to see them healthy and get in a couple months to a 3 months of games and see where some of these young hitters go. If they take the next step, or if they stay the same.
You mentioned those blown saves. That's been a lot of what's happened on the road, a lack of home runs, so many close games. And then the way they held them last year, they haven't been in the seventh inning or so this year. They've rewritten, revised, whatever. We used a lot of rewords. Rich, we're using a lot of rewords with the Cardinals this year. Retool, reboot, rewrite, re-envision, reimagine. We're not, you know, they're not using the word rebuild, but eventually it might come to that. But in the relievers, to use another reword, you know, they've kind of relooked at him over the past week. We'll see if this holds. Gordon Graceffo, you know, in spring training, they thought he was going to be an impact reliever for them at some point in time this year. It turns out that it's May, and we'll see how that holds. In reality, they're just going to cycle through relievers just like any other team does.
That happens. I mean, that's one position in baseball I've noticed that is just a revolving door, is that teams change their bullpens dramatically, seemingly every year. And the ones that do it well, the Padres bullpen is lights out. And the puzzle pieces fit so well because you've got guys with so many different release points, different stuff. It's a different look. The relief, I was there and watched three games, including the game where the fan fell out, which was really a obviously a sad thing. It's great to hear that he's doing better, but in watching every reliever that came out, it was a different arm angle. It was a lefty. The one lefty came over the top. Another was a sidewinder. You got guys with featuring different pitches. That's such a thing in baseball now, is that mix of relievers. And you want that variety. So I haven't seen enough of the Cardinals to really give you a breakdown of their bullpen right now. although the last podcast you had certainly did.
That's my job, yeah.
Yeah, it is. That's your job. So my job is to, you know, that's one of the areas that they can fix. I think there's enough bats in there that the power could come as you get to summer. So I'm still, you know, it's still quicksand right now. They're still stuck in the middle, and we'll see. Maybe they move the needle in the next month or two.
During spring training, I talked to Dave Martinez, manager of the Nationals, and I asked him, you know, as the Cardinals kind of entered into this era, look, for the entirety of the time I've covered the Cardinals, I started in 04. My first spring training was there in 05, but you were there with the Marlins. And for the entirety of that time, the Cardinals have been measured through one lens and one lens only, really, which is, did they win the National League pennant? Are they a contender for the championship? They've dialed that back. They've dialed back everything. They said, look, we're going to make less revenue. We're going to draw less fans. We're selling less tickets. We're going to have smaller crowds. We're going to have a smaller payroll. We're going to have smaller expectations. They've dialed all that back. And so I asked Dave Martinez, who, you know, the Nationals don't have the same history as the Cardinals, but they had a whopper of a payroll not too long ago.
Yes.
They collected stars. They said they're contenders, and they had those World Series aspirations, and they were rewarded for them. When they had Scherzer and Strasburg and that whole group. So I asked Dave Martinez, I said, what's the transition like for a manager to go from those millions and millions of dollars of expectation on a payroll to growing a team? And he said, you know, he had to remind himself sometimes in spring training when he's watching bullpens that he's watching young pitchers and not Max Scherzer. He's watching, you know, prospect A get ready for a season that he's never been ready for, or the length of which he's never been ready for, instead of Steven Strasburg. He said, you have to kind of bake that into your expectations. I give that long-winded prelude to ask you, you're about to cover a game or call a game with the Cardinals and the Nationals. How does where they are in the spectrum of contending inform how you call that game?
Well, I think essentially, especially on television, you're a storyteller. And in a national game, you need to give a snapshot to, look, there's going to be a ton of Cardinal fans watching. There'll be a ton of Nationals fans watching. But there'll be baseball fans watching. So giving a snapshot of a team accurately and honestly, I think in the first, you know, two or three innings. And I think tomorrow night, Ryan Spielborgs and I and Tricia Whitaker as well, the discussion around the Cardinals will be similar to the one that you and I are having right now, is who are these guys and where are they headed? Are the pieces they've got good enough? Or are those pieces keys to, you know, adding the pieces they're going to need next year and the year after? With the Nationals, it's a really fun and young team that's got some really good pieces. And they did it. I mean, I look at the Nationals and I think of three transactions in the last, 7 years or so that has shaped where they are right now. One is not re-signing Anthony Rendon, which could have been a disaster. And it's shipwrecked the Angels, in my opinion. The other is signing Steven Strasburg, which wasn't such a great thing. They're still paying $35 million a year of his contract through next year. And then there's deferred money after that. And the next one is the Soto trade.
Sure.
And when you trade someone like Soto, you really need to hit the mark in terms of what you get back. The landscape is littered with teams that traded big guys like him and didn't get what they wanted. I can think of the Marlins in particular when they traded Miguel Cabrera and got all those guys from the Tigers, and it really didn't have the same. But I mean, CJ Abrams and James Wood, those are pieces that really we will focus on, and the young talent that Davey Martinez has. And you know, going back to our conversation back 20 minutes ago, we were talking about how do you know if Derek Shelton's a good manager. Davey Martinez won a world championship, and yet he's been in Derek Shelton's position. Over the last 4 or 5 years, right? So those are the things. I mean, just looking at they've added a little bit. Nathaniel Lowe is a nice piece at first base. It sounds like, and look, Mike Rizzo is smart. He's an excellent general manager. It looks like they're going to try to add pieces and add payroll next year. So I think for the Nationals, you measure them like, hey, you know, they're not contending this year, but that's okay. Their plan of rebuild is starting to take root, and here are the pillars that they can build around. And for the Cardinals, the snapshot is there's guys here that could become great major league players, but there's a lot of question marks. You've got, you know, Nolan Arenado at third base. Should he stay or should he go? Mm-hmm. He's got some say over that, but there's probably, you know, what happens if the Yankees or the Mets or the Dodgers or somebody loses a third baseman and you can get a haul of good young players and boost that farm system, you know, close to major league ready players, that changes the whole look. So that's kind of the big picture going into the game. And certainly there's stars on both sides that you want to see, and we'll feature those as well.
I do wonder, you hit on it. I do wonder if that's the decision that shoves the Cardinals out of the middle, and then how their fan base will react to it. If they're right around 500 in a division where right around 500 is not out of it, and yet they can get a haul of prospects for closer Ryan Helsley, which direction will they go? I find that really fascinating. Like, that might be that's the tipping point right there where they're finally forced to make a call.
Yeah, you may not know until early July or mid-July, right? I mean, it's like here we are in early May trying to make these decisions and all of that. And as we know, having covered this sport for a long time, a lot of those decisions can change from now until the third week in July as you get closer to the deadline. And the pressure is on. An injury from another team, a need from another team oftentimes dictates when you jump and when you hold your cards.
I'm really interested in your perspective, having just seen the Padres and the Pirates and now getting ready for the Cardinals and the Nationals, and kind of merge that with the work you do with the Diamondbacks. The Diamondbacks
I was just the fill-in guy for the Diamondbacks.
No, I know.
But I know their organization pretty well.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to ask, because you'll be doing the Diamondbacks at the Cardinals game, is this notion that like the Diamondbacks are in the division with the Dodgers. They're in the division with some big spenders, the biggest spender of them all outside of the Mets. You have a real good feel for like that gap. And while the Cardinals get to play in what I've called the most neighborly division in baseball, they're just all very quaint and polite in the National League Central, they still have to close that gap at some point in time. They can't count on another team to knock out the Dodgers every October. How big a gap do you see between these teams and the Diamondbacks and the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers? And what do you think teams can learn from the Diamondbacks when you see them trying to close that, or the Padres trying to close that gap on the Dodgers?
Well, I think one of the big things that the Diamondbacks did really well, and he's not there anymore, he's the assistant pitching coach in Pittsburgh, is hire Brent Strong.
Yeah.
He really helped that some of those pitchers, the Merrill Kellys and guys that were there. He really helped them. Dan Heron, to drop a Cardinal name of the past, is also on their pitching staff. He's like their pitching strategist. He'll go through, and that's really progressive to me, because Heron was in Miami briefly for a year and just loved calling his games because he was so cerebral and he didn't throw his social media was, I throw 88 or whatever.
Yeah, it is, man.
Right? Yeah. He didn't throw real hard, but he got guys out. And so the fact that they leaned heavily into guys like that, and that's a real progressive thing. He would help starters with game plans and stuff going in. Strom was outstanding. Mike Hazen, their GM, had some really good drafts as well. Marte got, they made Marte the franchise guy, and he's lived up to that. And that's... Mm-hmm. And I think the lesson there is you don't have to be better than the Dodgers. You don't even have to be the Dodgers. You just got to get in the postseason. And that's how they got to the World Series. They were playing well at the end of that season. And they rode it all the way into the World Series. I think the Padres are kind of in that space too. It's like if you look at the Dodgers and say, we're going to have to win 105 games to be as good as the Dodgers. I think the key is, be healthy when you get to the postseason and be playing well. And the Diamondbacks did that. They're a fun team. And again, that's a organization that stuck with a manager that wasn't winning initially. And they helped build it, and he stuck around and got them to the World Series. And they're a fun team to watch. That should be a really good, entertaining series.
Absolutely. And I think you've touched on, or you like kind of alluded to it. I think one of the things about the modern game is the different styles of game we're seeing from teams. And yes, there's a real entertaining aspect. I mean, the Dodgers are fun to watch because they're a collection of stars.
I love to watch the Guardians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. This just feels like a confession here. But okay. Like, I dig the Guardians. You know, Stephen Kwan up front. Mm-hmm. You know, Stephen Vogt is such a fun man. Their run differential is like, what, minus 35 or something like that?
Yeah. They find ways.
Yeah, they're like four or five games over. So the style of play is, you're right, it is a fun time. And I think, you know, as grudgingly as baseball people like to admit it, I think the rule changes have really added to that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. They have. Yeah, good call. Bigger bases. The
limit of going over to first, the value of moving runners. The other thing that I and people dislike this, the ghost runner in the 10th inning, mm-hmm. I dig that. In fact, like when it first started, I would search on my app for games that went to extra innings just to watch and see how managers handle it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Because in the first year, a lot of managers just played like it's like, hey, we're swinging away, guy at second base, and guys are hacking and off their back mm-hmm. foot trying to launch. And then, like middle of the season, all of a sudden it was like, hey, let's move the runner over. You could see hitters trying to push the ball to the right side mm-hmm. to get that runner over to third with one out. So I like that format for a lot of reasons. Namely, I've called a lot of 18, 19 inning games and been there for 7 hours.
Yeah.
And that's miserable. But I like the fact that it turns the dial up on strategy and wheels turning and how do we get this run across and you know, scratch out a win.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, rules have evolved, style of play is evolving with them. You'll be part of the booth there for Friday Night Baseball on Apple TV Plus. That's not a phrase that 5 years ago I would have said. How is broadcasting baseball evolving, and what's headed our way in terms of how people view games and enjoy them?
Yeah. So look, there's, I know sometimes people get frustrated that there are games on different platforms and such. Mm-hmm. This is year four for Apple TV. This is my third year. I'm sort of the spot starter. And so I get a chunk of games here and a chunk of games there. I work with both crews. There are two games that are on the Friday night. Mm-hmm. And like I said, Ryan Spielborgs and Trisha Whitaker, I'm on this with this group this week and in 2 weeks when we're in St. Louis. The Apple shows are an absolute blast to call. And I'm fortunate. I get to do college football and basketball with CBS. They're awesome. And I've done showcase games. I've done Saturday Fox back in the day, some ESPN baseball when I was coming up. This show is just like really, really cool because Apple controls the vibe and the aesthetics. Their graphics are similar to what's on an iPhone. The music is really cool. The cameras they use are different than a lot of other national shows. They really push, and Major League Baseball has been great with access, mm-hmm. getting to players, talking to players, getting the camera in spots you don't normally see it. So for viewers who watch the games on Apple, and I think it's changed. I mean, the first year there were, you know, people were pushing back and they just wanted to hear, you know, Dan McLaughlin or Chip Carey or whoever the home voice is. But over the last couple of seasons, the tone has really changed from fans and from players. The players, when it's an Apple game, are into it because they watch baseball. They see those things, and they're obviously from a younger generation. So they're cool with a lot of the innovations. And I think fans, the cameras, the look, the vibe, is different, but I think fans have started to catch on to it. And there's an option on the show that if you really want a hometown voice, you can actually switch to carry your team's radio call.
Oh, interesting.
On the telecast as well. But look, it's produced by Major League Baseball, the mm-hmm. Apple people, Roy Stickerson, and his group, They have input on the aesthetics and content and stuff. It's a really good mix between the two entities to make the show. And it's, I think going forward, you're just going to see more innovation, more cameras in different places, a better way to present the game. And I think the thing that we try to do on Apple is introduce you to the players a little more. The dialogues, the interviews that we do are a little more long form. The manager interviews are a little more long form. The pregame show, we have Trisha will have a player from each team with a comprehensive interview instead of just like, you know, one or two questions type.
Cool.
All of that is a different feel and a different package. And as a play-by-play guy, it's really fun to, selfishly, it's really fun to call the games for him.
Yeah. You're the perfect person for me to ask this because you're doing college football and you do college basketball and you're never putting a mic on the defensive tackle as he's getting ready to go up against the offensive lineman. You're never putting a mic on the point guard as he's calling a play so that he can narrate it for the home audience as to what he's thinking and everything like that. But you are able to put a mic on the right fielder while they're playing the game, or left fielder while they're playing a game. What does that allow baseball to do, and how strong of a element is that for baseball to kind of connect with fans?
I think, look, it's there are times when I've seen it and it's uncomfortable a little bit. There are other times where I've seen it and it's like, wow, that was really cool. We do at times say where we mic the player but don't talk to him. So you can hear a middle infielder talking to his shortstop about who's got second base. You can hear a center fielder, you know, moving a left fielder closer. Hey, I got gap, or let's, you know, all of that stuff. That's I really like that a lot. So I think baseball is such a different sport than any other sport on television. If you think about football and hockey and basketball, there's a game camera and the game camera follows the play back and forth. And then you'll cut to replays and you'll cut to ISOs of coaches and hero shots of players. Whereas baseball, a producer and a director need different skills in those three sports. They have to find the ball. They have to follow the ball with camera cuts. And certain cameras have certain spots on the field. So anything you can do, I think, to bring the fans closer to the game, you know, the camera that gets out on the field, that takes the pitcher out for first pitch, the camera, our Megalodon camera, they call it, that gets to third base when a guy's hit a home run and gets actually on the infield grass and follows him down into not only home plate, but also all the way into the dugout. That's the cool stuff. I mean, that's, I see it. I live in the Seattle area, and I about two blocks from my house are a couple of Little League fields. And on, you know, some days I'll walk the dog down there and stop and watch some of the Little League game. And I see the impact of how games are televised now. You know, Little League guys, they have walk-up songs for one thing, right? Yeah. But they have that kind of that dugout routine, you know, where it's put the sport coat on or the trident in Seattle, or, you know, take a picture if you're the Padres or whatever it is. They've got that in the dugout, and they've got that because television has, you know, broadcasters have cameras in the dugout. Broadcasters have audio in the dugout now. You can hear when a guy has a big hit or a big moment, there's usually that shot at the end of the dugout of the player coming down the gauntlet of teammates and stuff like that. That's the stuff. That, to me, is great the stuff point. That you just don't get on most telecasts. And even when you're at the park, you don't see that stuff. I'm always a big fan of taking a viewer, whatever sport it is, someplace that you don't have access to, that nobody has access to, whether it's through conversation with an offensive coordinator or a defensive coordinator, sitting in on a film session in college football, going to practice with basketball and talking to players about certain situations and plays, or in baseball, you know, you can do it as an announcer by, you know, pitching coach, manager, hitting coach, player has, you know, we have access, and you as well as writers, we have access that nobody else has. Everybody at home that's watching has the same information we have, right? The notes are online, research is online, stats are online, and they can get there faster than we can because we're calling the game and they're watching the game. But what they don't have is they don't have the ability to sit in the manager's office for 20, 25 minutes and talk about players and concepts and stuff. And I think it's incumbent upon broadcasters to communicate through the manager. Communicate that Ollie Marmol says this about Burleson or Donovan or
whatever. Right, right. Yeah.
Because that holds a hell of a lot more cachet than if I just say it. If I say, Wilson Contreras is doing this, is this far along in his defense at first base, people at home are like, huh?
Yeah.
Who cares? But if it comes from Daniel Descalzo or if it comes from somebody in authority, suddenly that catches the attention. And I think the same is true with cameras and looks and audio. And the more we can get in places that fans don't normally see, I think the more entertaining and the better off the game is.
Yeah, I love that dugout thing. One of the best parts about it is it's clippable for social media.
Yes.
Like it fits on TikTok. It fits in our reel. You can watch it on loops and it's not it fits very well. And then the camera angles that you guys take are so cinematic that it takes like, okay, Roy Hobbs and what we're used to seeing on the silver screen, right? Like an angle that, you know, like in 04, I remember being pushed aside by a camera as they were doing the fever pitch thing, right? And they were trying to get this cinematic view of the celebration of Jimmy Fallon and all this stuff. Now that is part of baseball broadcast. It's not just to broadcast it on the silver screen. It's to take fans inside the lines and see it in a cinematic scope. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and Apple and MLB Network, to their credit, know the value of that and spend the money on that. And that's what makes, I think, separates this product from others.
That's cool. Well, so are we going to get the big UC Davis reunion then in the middle of the game? UC Davis shortstop talking to UC Davis shortstop as you interviewed Descalzo?
Well, look, I played in the dead ball era, right?
Before the reflex bats?
Yeah, before Descalzo came in and hit like 400 at my school. No, I was a college middle infielder, shortstop at UC Davis long ago, and Daniel was as well. And not a lot of UC Davis guys have been to the big leagues. Ty Kelly was another versatile infielder, a lot like Descalzo. When Ty Kelly got there and I was doing games for the Marlins, that was pretty cool. And we had, I was in St. Louis and got to meet him because I left the Bay Area, California to climb my way through the minor leagues. So I didn't really spend any time around my alma mater or the baseball program after that. So just to get to introduce myself and say hi to him and say, hey, look, I played where you played, but it was a while earlier than you. It's great to see you in the big leagues. And he had just got to the big leagues and he hit a home run to right. And it was his first major league home run. And I got to call it. And that was really cool.
That's pretty cool.
And I'm glad he's gotten a chance to get in uniform and as a bench coach and all that. I think at some point he's going to manage. Yeah. And I think he's going to be really good at it.
Yeah, he, John Jay, Skip Schumacher, that whole group of folks that have gone through the Cardinals. And
More of them, please. Those guys are always good.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, I want to close with this question because, again, you're well-situated to answer it. I talked to you before we started recording about how you've called 6 no-hitters, which invites the question, when is it appropriate to bring it up? You've broadcast 6 no-hitters, so at what point in time are you not cursing it by bringing it up?
It's funny. As a young broadcaster, my first no-hitter was Anibal Sanchez.
Okay.
And that was my first experience calling a no-hitter. And I wrestled with that in the game. You know, do you disguise it by saying he hasn't given up any hits? Do you say the word no-hitter? And I said it, but not as much as I should have. And he pitches the no-hitter. And after that, I was like, you know, that's stupid. And then I read an article where Vin Scully always said no hitter. Vin Scully always, and when someone challenged him on it, he said, it's my job to tell people what's happening. And if I don't tell them what's happening, they may turn the channel and not know it's a no hitter. And that's not right. So from that point on, I was really, you know, fifth, sixth inning. It's a no hitter. He hasn't given up a hit. You get to the seventh or the eighth, and you don't bombard people with it, but you note it, and they can do it visually. They can show the line score on the scoreboard. You know, Sanchez here in the eighth hasn't given up a hit, and he's facing the bottom third of the order here in the eighth, but he's got the top of the order in the ninth. If I'm watching on television, I flip the game on and it's 3-0 and it's the eighth inning and the announcer doesn't say it's a no hitter. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I turn the channel. You know, that,
yeah,
you have to be honest. I have nothing to do with, you know, it's like, for the Angels, I was filling in. Patrick Sandoval had a no hitter in the ninth in Minnesota. And on a check swing, he lost it with one out. And I had said no hitter from like the sixth or the seventh inning on. Again, not beating it in the ground, but letting people know. And yeah, they do put it on the screen with graphics as well. And there were a few fans that were like, how could you do that? You have know nothing about baseball if you say that. It's like, look, it didn't hurt the other six that I called.
Yeah.
I didn't jinx Roy Halladay's perfect game.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but right. I've had two of the weirdest no-hitters ever in my opinion. Henderson Alvarez, end of the season, Detroit Tigers. I forget the year. Henderson Alvarez was kind of a goofy pitcher to begin with. And he's got a no-hitter going. It's a scoreless game. It's the last game of the season. And he gets to the top of the eighth, and he gets through it and gets the third out. And it's scoreless. And he's hopping off the mound, looking around like,
yeah.
And then all of a sudden, no one's coming over to him. And he looks up, and he had lost track. He knew he had a no-hitter going, but he really wasn't looking at the score. So it's not a no-hitter. The rules are you got to, you know, complete the game, win the game.
Yeah.
So the Marlins load the bases with two outs. And I think either it's Greg Dobbs or Stanton is at the plate. And the on-deck hitter is Henderson Alvarez. Now, Alvarez can't come to the plate because there's two outs and the bags are loaded and it's scoreless. Either a run scores or you're going to the 10th.
Right.
But there's Alvarez with his batting gloves on. He's oblivious to all this. He's swinging with a donut, getting ready to. And sure enough, wild pitch. And you're thinking to yourself between innings, how do you call a no-hitter when the pitcher's not on the mound?
Yeah.
And finishes the game. You know, there's a pop-up and it's caught, and that's a no-hitter. Or there's a run and it's a no-hitter. That's weird, right? Well, the fact is he's on deck. So he's on camera, and it's like, there's him. So then you can start telling, there's Henderson out. Like, I almost want to break into Vince Scully. There's Henderson Alvarez. And wouldn't it be unique if he got the no-hitter? And so you're on the edge of your seat again. It's like, there he is. If this run scores, it's a no-hitter. If not, he's coming out to pitch the 10th inning, and the Tiger right-hander, I forget, bounced the pitch. And sure enough, it was Stanton that scored from – it was Dobbs at the plate. Stanton scored. And then that's your no-hitter call. And the director captured it perfectly. Alvarez celebrated in the on-deck circle just like he was on the mound.
The first no-hitter with a guy with a bat in his hand.
Yes. The other one was in COVID. It was Cubs, Brewers, Mills.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Mills for the Cubs is pitching, and it's a remote game. Turner had called me to do – it's COVID, so you're doing the game. It's on Turner Sunday. And I'm in a studio in Atlanta, and Ron Darling's in a studio in New York, and the game's in Milwaukee, and we're calling the game, and I can see Ron in a little monitor, but we're both kind of delayed, and it was really hard. By the time we got to the sixth inning, it's a no-hitter, and you're like, geez, I can't even, and all I have is the view of the screen. So when the ball leaves the bat, I have no clue where the fielders are or anything. So we were just like on the edge of our seat for until the ninth, and two outs. Grisham, Trent Grisham, I believe, is the hitter with the guy with the golf grip batting And there's two outs. He hits the seed right up the middle. And your first reaction is that's a base hit. But since you're doing it remotely, you pause briefly.
Oh, yeah.
Because you know, just because you want to make sure, you know. And sure enough, I think it was Javi Baez had shaded towards second. Mm-hmm. And on one hop, the ball finds Baez right behind the bag, fires the first no hitter. And I swear to God, I lost 10 pounds sweating the last three innings. And walked out of that studio in Atlanta, wow, just like, God, on national TV, you're calling a no-hitter and you can't really see the ball anywhere.
Wow.
But look, it's not those are, I don't, it's not a on, it's not a badge of honor. It's not a look what I've accomplished in my career. It's luck. Mm-hmm. It's pure happenstance that I was there. So I look at it as I've been very, very lucky to see those see those games. And I had the most dominant no hitter I've ever seen wasn't in Major League Baseball.
Oh, right.
I was doing a super regional for ESPN in 2019. Kumar Rocker of Vanderbilt facing Duke, elimination game for Vandy. Mm-hmm. Threw a no hitter and he struck out 19, and every strikeout was with a slider.
Wow. Wow. That's impressive. Everything. Well, it adds to the stories.
Very lucky to be there.
Sure, yeah. But it's all about accumulating stories that you can tell and, you know, that add to the broadcast, right?
Yeah, that's the good stuff. That's the fun stuff. You know, calling balls and strikes is one thing, and you got to let people know what's going on in the game, but you also have to give them some insight on who these players are, what they're about, and mix in a little history as well. Chip does that really well. Dan did that really well. And the Cardinals have such a rich history to draw from, whether it's, you know, the team in the 70s, the Whitey Ball and or Tony La Russa and all of that. And mm-hmm. go back even further than that. That's such a treasure of a history that if you're one of the Cardinal broadcasters, that's a really a good thing to have.
Same is true for Cardinal writing. You have to you benefit from all the decades of the past to, you know, either provide context. Or we had Victor Scott. We watched him score from first.
Oh,
to
yeah,
home. And of course the mad dash of Enos Slaughter gets mentioned. So you have like these right. touchstones. Of
well,
course.
Look, I thought, you know, watching that highlight, I'm thinking of when I was playing in college. It was Vince Coleman and Willie McGee, and McGee sure. came from a junior college right near me. From my area. And so I was keenly aware of his career. Those teams were just like so much fun to watch. Put the ball in play, mad dash, Hernandez, all those guys.
Yeah, this Cardinals team could benefit from a little charisma like that. Rich, thank you very much for joining me. This has been great. It's Rich Waltz, part of the Friday Night Baseball crew there for Apple TV Plus, covering the Cardinals-Nats game. And then, of course, he'll be in St. Louis doing the same for the Diamondbacks Cardinals game. So really looking forward to it. Rich, thank you so much for this time. It's been a pleasure talking to you here at DC, and I look forward to seeing you at the ballpark.
See you at the ballpark tomorrow night.
Thanks to Rich Waltz for joining me here in DC to talk about his preparation and what he expects and how he approaches the Cardinals Nationals game he'll be calling on Friday Night Baseball for Apple TV Plus. That's where you can find that game. You can find all the constant Cardinals coverage there at the Post Dispatch and scltoday.com. I'll be there for the first two cities of this road trip and then handing the baton off to my colleague Daniel Guerrero to cover the series for quote unquote rivalry weekend in Kansas City. You can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcasts. It's available on iTunes, on Spotify. Please rate and review the podcast. Subscribe if possible. Subscriptions make sponsorships possible, and sponsorships make this podcast possible. Best podcast in baseball is brought to you weekly by Closets by Design of St. Louis. For BPIB, and thanks to Rich Waltz of the Friday Night Baseball crew on Apple TV Plus, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
there's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine-washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.